Well, how do you like biographies to end? The hero achieves all that he sets out to do and ends his days in an idyllic and contented retirement, his legacy secure in history, his children and his successors carrying on the solid foundations which he has established. Or perhaps you relish stories built on what P.G. Woodhouse once called the oldest plot in the world. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, and then everyone lives happily ever after in a state of near-permanent euphoria. Of course, it's not real. Because real life, the life of real relationships, of real marriages, real jobs, real businesses and professions, rarely matches these formulae. Real life is often messy and complicated, isn't it? Marriages break down. Our children foul up. We don't achieve some of our deepest ambitions. We get ill. We grow weary. We let one another down. Haven't you felt something of that this week with Jeffrey Archer's conviction? So much energy and talent and potential, and yet such deep flaws. But let's not get smug, for that's us, isn't it? That's fallen humanity. And what is true in personal and social life is also tragically true in church life. Oh, there will be a time in heaven when our troubles in the church will be over, but to expect that now is to indulge in fantasy and delusion. The Bible is constantly realistic about the flaws of so many of its main players. We see that time after time. Abraham tries to deceive. Jacob cheats. Moses loses his temper. David commits adultery. Peter lies. It's a story of failures in key people at key moments in the story. Personal stories spoilt by sin. Our story in the church. Well, for the last 9 Sunday evenings, we've been looking at the autobiography of Nehemiah, an Old Testament spiritual giant of the mid-5th century BC. Chapters 1 to 7, and now chapter 13, read like extracts from his diary. They're in the first person, I. Chapters 8 to 12 read a little bit more like official records, which he wrote into his narrative, when, perhaps as a retirement task, and he was, among other things, a politician, whatever else he was, perhaps as he was preparing his memoirs for publication, he wrote in chapters 8 to 12 from the official record. It's a remarkable story, as we've seen, covering the rebuilding of Jerusalem's walls, chapters 1 to 6, the renewing of Jerusalem's worship in chapters 8 to 10, and then, as we saw last week, the repopulating of Jerusalem's streets in chapters 11 and 12. It's a story of the renewing and sanctifying of the people of God. That's why time after time, in our applications, we find ourselves talking about the church. For the church today is the covenant community, God's people, Israel, if you like, internationalized, globalized, through and under the unifying dominion of King Jesus. And the way in which God dealt with people in covenant with himself then, people of true faith, is packed with lessons, as we've seen, for the way in which he deals with those of us who are united to Christ today and who are living by faith. But our focus, you see, is no longer God dwelling in a Middle Eastern city, Jerusalem, but in the worldwide spiritual community which is his temple today, the fulfillment, if you like, of all that Jerusalem was looking towards. And just as Jerusalem then needed to be in good shape to honor God and to be a public, visible statement, so the church today needs to be the same. Nehemiah, through God, built walls. And now God, through Nehemiah, is concerned to build saints. But if you like your biographies to end on an upbeat note, then chapter 13, I'm afraid, is a bit of an anticlimax. A more superficial writer might have packed it in and wrapped it up at chapter 12 on an upbeat note, as we saw last week, celebrating the vibrant worship, verses 27 to 43, or the generous giving of verse 47, or the diligent service of 45 and 46, or even the obedient listening that's there in the beginning of chapter 13, and the apparent commitment to spiritual purity in the community. But life's not like that a lot of the time. And this concluding chapter of the book is a powerful reminder that the church, then as now, can slip. We wobble, friends. We have our ups and downs. Easily and often imperceptibly, things can decline, and what one year looks so strong and healthy and spiritually vibrant, by the next can be, frankly, a shambles. We need to understand the chronology here. Nehemiah's first stint in Jerusalem lasted 12 years. We learn that in chapter 5, verse 14. He then returned to Susa for an unknown number of years before returning, with the king's permission, for a second term. That's there in chapter 13, verses 6 and 7. He returns for a second term as governor. Now, we don't know what age he was when he was appointed governor first, but it's a reasonable assumption to make that he was about 40, so by now he's possibly pushing 60. Certainly, as we'll see in this chapter, he doesn't pull his punches or mince his words. And he arrives back to see that the renewal movement to which he had devoted so much time and energy has worryingly stalled. And he's frankly angry about it. He doesn't like what he sees. Some combination of sheer stupidity and indiscipline has admitted to the temple and to the highest councils of power men on the make like Tobiah, who've got no interest at all in faithfulness towards God and his word. As if that's not bad enough, temple worship has deteriorated as the clergy and musicians have been starved of resources. There are more problems. Commercial interests have undermined completely Sabbath observance. And mixed marriages have come to pose a threat to Hebrew culture itself. And after all he tried to do in leadership, here he is, coming back to find things in a real muddle. And you know, anybody who has ever attempted anything in Christian leadership knows the frustration and the disappointment of a very special kind when things in which you have invested so much turn pear-shaped. There are surely three lessons here for us in the church, and the first is this. Mountaintop moments can't be maintained in the church. Nehemiah is a book packed with mountaintop moments. You know, vintage experiences for the people who were involved. God was there. He was at work. People were changed. This was revival. Covenant renewal. The dedication of the walls. The pledges that people made. Yes, Lord, we'll do it. We love you. We're committed to you. We'll make the changes you require. Perhaps you've been there yourself at a conference or, you know, after a powerful sermon. God's presence has seemed so real. An emotion has gripped us, and we resolve to live for him alone. And then, well, a month later, a week later in some cases, where are you? Well, things aren't quite so clear. God's glory is not quite the driving force it seemed when we were on that high. Things aren't just so black and white. Life is complicated and a bit messy. You know, it's always been like that in the church. God-given times of great spiritual intensity and major achievement in ministry are often followed by times of decline. It's there in the New Testament. Think of the surge of the gospel after Pentecost, and then the muddles that the church got itself into, which have to be addressed in so many of the epistles. Think of the theological and ethical shambles that Paul, the master evangelist, had to address at the end of his life in those churches which he planted. Or think of those letters of Jesus, the end of the New Testament. The letters to the seven churches of Revelation. Ephesus, for example, with all its fine qualities, but it had gone wrong. It had lost its first love. It had lost the best. And when its lampstand was removed, so was the light extinguished in one of the great cities of the ancient world. And today it's a pile of stones. So we need to be realistic in the church about our vulnerability. God doesn't bestow mountaintop experiences on a constant basis. For the Christian life to be all thrills, you see, would work against maturity and inner toughness. And the ripening and toughening process is what is central to God's plan for each one of us. And yet the danger in the church is constantly that we tend to become spiritually careless, don't we? We slip into sliding disobedience. We drift into creeping decay. You know, none of us naturally drifts towards holiness. And apart from grace-driven effort, people don't naturally gravitate towards prayer or obedience to the Bible or faith or delight in God. No, we drift in exactly the opposite direction. We drift towards compromise and we call it tolerance. We drift towards disobedience and we call it freedom. We abandon self-control and we call it liberation. We embrace carelessness and we call it being relaxed. Nehemiah faced all these things when he got back to Jerusalem. Nothing's changed. Second lesson is this. Conformity to the world is a constant snare for the church. Israel's lapses in the Old Testament and a lot of teaching in the New Testament remind us, if we need any reminding, that the world, that is society, organized apart from God, is always trying to squeeze Christians individually and the church corporately into its own mold. The world wants us to share its preconceptions, its prejudices, its lifestyle, its mindset of whatever time in which the church finds itself. Church, on the other hand, is called under the leadership of King Jesus to permeate and to purify the society in which it is, to inject God's values at every level. And these are true human values in which we can have confidence as we try to inject those into the life of our society. The goal of the church is cultural transformation. And it's a fight. Because of the church in the world, it has been said that while the place for the ship is in the sea, it can only mean disaster when the sea gets into the ship. And don't we see that in the church so often? Sub-Christian bilge seeping into the church all the time. The way we think, the way we behave, compromise, compromise, compromise. We all get squeezed by worldly mindedness, don't we, in the church? It's as old as the fall. Did God really say? And under Nehemiah's leadership, the families of the returned exiles have made so many promises. They're all there in chapter 10. Promises to tithe, promises to maintain the temple and its staff, promises to sanctify the Sabbath, to cut out mixed marriages. But you can almost hear them say it, can't you? Well, you know, we need to live in the real world. Business is business. And there's the family and the future to think about. And actually, Tobiah seems a very charming fellow. And suddenly, self-interest is in the saddle. And we've compromised on God's standards and God's glory. You know, I think a lot in my own life about a chap called Demas. You may know about Demas. He merits a poignant one-liner in 2 Timothy 4:10. And I understand his problem so well. And I so don't want to be like him. You know, he should probably be the patron saint of 40-something professionals in the church. Demas was a key colleague of Paul and Dr. Luke at one point. But he simply deserts the work, we are told, because, do you know why? He loved the world. He loved the world. And, you know, I know exactly what that means. I feel the psychological choke of that every week of my life. And Nehemiah 13 is a reminder, if we need one, that the world's squeeze is very dangerous to God's people. Mountaintop experiences can't be maintained in the church. Conformity to the world is a constant snare to the church. And the third point that I want to spend a few more moments on is discipline is a constant need in the church. Because most of this chapter, one way or another, is about discipline. And, you know, you just need to mention the word and you know, you can just feel a little bristle. Because perhaps it's because in our politically correct, non-judgmental, rather smooth post-Christian climate, we're a bit uncomfortable about telling anyone what to do. or about telling anybody how to behave. And frankly, because of that, some of this chapter, you may have felt, as it was read, feels a bit heavy. Well, it is a bit heavy, I'm afraid. And unfortunately, Nehemiah breaks rule number one of church leadership. Thou shalt be nice. Because I'm afraid he's not. In fact, here he's a bit of a tornado. You see what he gets up to? Verse 8, I threw out. Verse 9, I gave orders. Verse 11, I rebuked. End of verse 15, I warned. Verse 22, I commanded. It even gets a bit physical in verse 25. I called down curses, I beat some of the men, and I pulled out their hair. Be thankful that Richard Bewes is our rector, friends. I mean, has Nehemiah by this stage just become a bad-tempered, cranky old autocrat? Well, no, because leaders, spiritual leaders, are people filled with the Spirit. So we can surely discount here, whatever we make of these outbursts, we can discount that these are angry, personalized, egotistic outbursts of a cranky old man. No, I mean, our problem is the other way. Because of our pathological niceness, we're sometimes frightened to bite the bullet of discipline at all. So almost anything goes, as long as people aren't upset. But Nehemiah reminds us, doesn't he, as did Jesus himself, that there is a place for anger, for outrage. Outrage at what sin does in human life. Outrage when worldliness invades the church. Outrage when spiritual leaders lead us astray, or when spiritual ruin is just round the corner in a life. We are right to be outraged. We're right to be angry about these things. And indeed, it's an indictment of us if we're not, because it poses the question, how much are we really longing for God's glory and opposed to all that obscures or obstructs it? You know, if we can't feel angry about sin in the life of the church, then there's something wrong with us. There's a passion here about Nehemiah, and we've seen that all through the book, really. There's a passion here which shows up our shallowness, doesn't it? A passion for God's honor and reputation. Well, Nehemiah addresses problems in three key areas, and I want to just take a moment or two on each. The temple, first of all, verses 4 to 14. The Sabbath, verses 15 to 22. And finally, the family, 23 to 28. Three key areas: the temple, the Sabbath, and the family. First, the temple. Eliashib the priest had made several serious but not uncommon errors for people in spiritual leadership. First, he had cultivated a wrong relationship, close association, as it's called, verse 4. In this case, it was with Tobiah. And Tobiah, we know, had been something of a thorn in Nehemiah's side for years. And Tobiah was a shrewd mover, and he was now ingratiating himself with the Jewish establishment. The second problem that Eliashib had was that he had misused his office. Verse 5. He had made available a large storeroom in the temple precincts as a rather desirable sort of city center pied-à-terre for this dangerous opponent of God's people. And thirdly, the net effect of all this was that he had frustrated God's work, because this very room, which Tobiah turned into a rather smart flat, was the place in which the tithes and the offerings were to be stored for the temple staff and the musicians. So it was a vicious circle. No tithes, no staff salaries. No staff salaries, no worship and music. And the whole system of worship was gradually grinding to a halt as a result. And when Nehemiah appraises the situation, he sees it, verse 7, as it is an evil thing. And verse 8, he acts decisively, and throws Tobiah and all his stuff out. And then in 9 to 13, he reestablishes things on a solid footing, to which the people respond, verse 12, with enthusiasm. It's interesting, isn't it, that there are echoes here, aren't there, of another time when somebody threw people out of the temple. Do you remember that? Why, it was Jesus. Jesus took equally decisive action in relation to those stall holders and money changers in the temple precinct. We're right, you see, to be outraged at anything that keeps people from God or that obscures or obstructs the gospel. And if that's the result of a corrupt or a compromised church, or worse still, its leaders, then like Nehemiah, we should be apoplectic. That's the temple. The second problem that he addresses is the Sabbath. Because the problem was, verse 17, and he says it again in verse 18, the Sabbath was being desecrated by commerce. Verse 15, the wine presses were being trod. The donkeys were being loaded. The Sabbath, which was to have been such a special day, a day for remembering and celebrating the work of God in creation and redemption, a day that was meant to be delightful and not dreary, a rest day set aside for God, set apart people, all that had gone. They'd packed all that in because there was some money to be made. And again, Nehemiah acts decisively. Do you see that? He forbids the Sabbath markets. He reasons with and rebukes the opinion formers, those nobles of Judah, in verses 17 and 18. He presents his arguments. And then he takes practical action because he shuts the city gates, verse 19. He warns off the traders, verse 21. Now, of course, the Old Testament Sabbath was supposed to speak to the watching world of a people whose supreme priority was God. That was the point of the Sabbath. And Nehemiah was outraged because what he found was a Sabbath which was speaking primarily of business and business interests. And he's outraged about that. Now, of course, we can't and shouldn't simply transfer wholesale the Jewish Sabbath to our Christian Sunday, the Lord's Day, as the New Testament calls it in three places. And, you know, we won't even necessarily agree in a congregation like this about what is or is not appropriate on Sundays. There will be different views about shopping and entertainment and sport and work. And I often think that our cultures and our upbringings often influences us as much in relation to some of these things as our theology. But what I'm sure we will agree about is that this is a day of special spiritual opportunity, isn't it? Sunday is a day of worship together. It's a day for the health of our souls. That's why it exists. The Puritans used to call it the market day of the soul. It's a great phrase, isn't it? What does how we use Sunday say about our priorities? I suppose that's the question. Is it just another day, part of the routine? Or do we prepare for it? Make the most of it. Take care that it's not crowded out by the everyday concerns of secular life. So if you're a student, Nehemiah might say to you, don't work 7 days a week, you'll be a poorer student. Take a day off. Forget the library. Laugh at the books on a Sunday. Rejoice in the liberty of not having to open them. Well, you know, I've tried to do that for 30 years, and it works. And if you're a barrister, prepare your case for Monday on Saturday, after you've written your sermon, so that your Sunday can be an entirely relaxing experience in front of 900 people. You know, friends, the pressure is on us about Sunday, isn't it? Because our culture is annihilating the identity of Sunday. Keep Sunday Special was a good slogan for a fine campaign some years back on the shops issue. And, you know, I'm sure that the lesson of Nehemiah 13 is that we need as Christians to go further, and we need to say to each other constantly, make Sunday special. Well, I've just got time to touch on the third problem area as we close. The family. Family. The problem with God is that he tells people how to live, and we don't like to be told. It unsettles some of us to learn that God is interested in who you marry and how you bring up your children, if you are privileged enough to marry and to have children. Nehemiah's problem with mixed marriages was very specific to his time. I mean, this all sounds so strange today when we read it, because the agenda for us is completely different. What was at stake then was the very survival of a particular people in a particular culture at a particular time for a unique purpose. Verse 24, that's why some of this exclusivity sounds so alien to us. It sounds almost racist, doesn't it, as we read it. But it's very specific, because the problem is, verse 24, if you don't know Hebrew as a language, you can't learn the law. And if you don't know the law, you don't know how to live to please God, and you can't take part in the life of the community. So you're in a difficulty. And if that goes on, and if enough people do that, the problem, quite simply, is that the future of the nation becomes endangered. And desperate situations call for desperate remedies. And you see the intensity of Nehemiah's crossness, because the people back in chapter 10 had promised, you know, we'll stop these mixed marriages. We will commit ourselves to the purity of the nation. But all that had gone, and they'd forgotten. And there were businesses to be built, and alliances to be made, and life had to be got on with, or so they said, but at a cost of God being their top priority. And, you know, today, if you're a Christian and you marry someone who's not a Christian, you're embarking on a sort of mixed marriage. I mean, there is no issue today about Christians marrying people of different races. That's all gone. I mean, any difficulties that arise in respect of that sort of mixed marriage may be the product of our prejudices or our family's difficulties, but that's nothing to do with what this chapter of Nehemiah is about. No, today, if you marry someone who's not a Christian, you are embarking on a sort of mixed marriage. Oh, you're not imperiling the church in the way that these people were imperiling Israel, but you're still, you know, imperiling your own spiritual well-being personally, for you are diminishing that covenant relationship with God which ought to come first in your life. It's a hard word, but it's an important word. You're breaking faith with him. It's not surprising, you know, that Nehemiah, as a thoughtful pastoral leader, grapples here with family, the family, and family issues. Because thoughtful pastoral leaders always focus on family and family life. For the family is the first and most basic form of the human community. Family nurture shapes children's lives. Families are the units out of which each church is built. Godliness is to be modeled there. Faith is to be passed on there. None of this has changed. And yet, what do we find? All over the Western world, family life is being weakened and undermined by all sorts of pressures. So the need to work as Nehemiah worked, to keep family life in the church strong and godly and wholesome, has never been greater. So if at All Souls from time to time we're banging on about marriage and the family, forgive us. Well, no, don't forgive us, because it's so important. It needs to be a prime concern in church life. Well, time has gone, and I need to draw to a close. Here's the great Nehemiah. We've spent nearly 10 weeks in his autobiography, and it's been a thrilling time. Three simple lessons for tonight. Mountaintop experiences can't be maintained in the church. Conformity to the world is a constant snare to the church. And discipline is a constant need in the church. And how does this realist, this biblical realist, end his memoirs? Well, as he began them, with prayer. Do you see that each little block of problems is punctuated by a simple, single prayer in this chapter? Had you noticed that? O God, remember. Three of them ask for God to remember me in mercy, 14, 23, and 31. And one in verse 29 asks him to remember Eliashib's family for judgment. See, here ultimately is the prayer of someone who is walking with a moment-by-moment awareness of God's reality. Here is the prayer of the Christian leader, the spiritual leader, free from triumphalism or spiritual pride. The man for whom God's well done will be more than enough reward. Of Nehemiah's famous exit line in verse 31, remember me with favor, or as the Authorized Version has it, for good, O my God. Matthew Henry, the great Puritan commentator, puts it very well. This, he says, may be the summary of our petitions. We need no more to make us happy than this. Remember me, O my God, for good. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the lessons of this remarkable book. Make us people of passion and courage and commitment. Thank you for Nehemiah's vision of a great God and for his vision of the family of God permeating society. Help us, Heavenly Father, to share that vision and to bring it about for your greater glory. Amen.